At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. With me is a man without principles but a beautiful smile, Michael Walker. How you doing, Walker?
The eye candy, baby.
I am your co-host, Mark Bigney. I have some follow-up from last week, and this is something I am amazed that only one listener pointed out. Ever since it was pointed out to me, I was waiting for the deluge of emails to come in. In my discussion of Dominion last week, we talked about deck builders, and frequent reference, of course, was made to Dominion. I inadvertently mixed up the cellar and the chapel, which is unforgivable. Now, in my defense, this is mitigation. I still shouldn't be forgiven. The cellar, I think, ought to do what the chapel does, and the chapel can do whatever you want it to do, maybe what the cellar does.
Our one listener got back to us. But
yes, 100% of our audience gave us the feedback. Thank you very much. Yes, I do sincerely apologize for getting that detail wrong. It is the chapel that is the all-important trashing card in Dominion that took the Dominion community and the board gaming community more broadly a little bit of time to cotton on to. I apologize for any confusion that caused, and of course, I offer my sincere condolences to Donald X. Vaccarino.
So we're going to talk about the games we played this week, and then we're going to talk about some news and why it doesn't matter, and then to our feature game, which is Nucleum. It's like a superhero, I think, right?
Not quite.
I hope so.
No. All right. That might have made the theming better.
Might change my notes.
So, Walker, what'd you play last week?
We went back to Kingdom Rush. We've been streaming on Wednesdays, and we played Scenario 3 from Kingdom Rush, or It Played Us, I guess you could say. Kingdom Rush is designed by Alara Cameron, Helena Hope, and Senfu Lim, published by Lucky Duck Games, and it's based off of a computer game, which is a tower defense where you also control a hero. And I think they've done a very great job of implementing that into a board game fashion. Now these cards of hordes are moving towards the exit like they do in the video game, except, and they're in little groups on the card, and you have to use polyomino shapes to cover them up, and all your different abilities and spells and tower effects all generate different sort of shapes of polyominoes. It's not like this huge variety. It's like one space or two space. You know, it's not a huge different things, but it's still very interesting to sort of puzzle out how exactly you're going to, you know, control.
It gives your attacks, in my experience, a little bit of texture past just this mob has 5 hit points and I'm doing a couple points of damage to it. There's a little bit more to it, and it encourages a kind of pseudo combined arms effect to be able to cover the different shapes that you need to cover.
Yep, very nice and puzzly. If you have soldiers or your heroes on cards, they don't get to move, so it's figuring out which cards you're going to hold in place, how are you going to make enough room for the cards that are going to spawn next turn, trying to eliminate as many cards as you can, which generate you income, which let you buy more towers. You have this interesting pass towers to other players and don't use them this turn, but they get free upgrades. The new Kingdom Rush also now lets you modify towers, which give them like little perks that you can buy with the new currency, which is coins.
Like a little throw rug to pull everything together.
Exactly. Yeah. Little pictures, right? Little photographs on the wall.
Sure.
Making it personal.
Some credence tapes.
Just so.
Yeah.
So that is Kingdom Rush. Having more fun with it, I'm sure we're going to return this coming Wednesday. Whether we're going to try Scenario 3 or push on again is yet to be determined.
Because it's been beating you up rather badly, hasn't it?
Oh, no, we got through the first two.
Oh, okay.
Okay. But this third one, we lost almost immediately.
Oh, wow.
And we reset and lost a second time. The scaling is quite extensive.
The scaling is real?
Yes.
On the topic of getting your behind handed to you, I return to Assault on Doomrock Ultimate Edition, which, full disclosure, one has to remove the Banner of Kekistan because otherwise your copy has cryptofascism in it, and we do not support the inclusion of cryptofascist imagery in Assault on Doomrock, but this has been covered by an errata. It was a sincere error on the part of the designer and publisher, Tom Stasiak.
And yes, we're going to mention it every time.
Yeah, each and every time. I've been exploring some of the additional modules. One of the great virtues of the Ultimate Edition of Assault on Doomrock is there's a whole bunch of optional modules that you can graft on, custom dice, special versions for the solo game. You can have a goon instead of playing simultaneously playing two heroes, which is what I did with the prior version. There's also terrain as the optional module. And this time I experimented with the goons because I was playing solo. And I'm not 100% sure whether a goon is better or worse than another character in terms of overall effectiveness. And one of the reasons why I'm not sure is because Assault on Doomrock's base difficulty level is absurdly difficult in a very pleasing way. And so, of course, I'm going to be losing terribly. So I'm not in a position to parse why I'm losing terribly by virtue of what module or what. I'm losing terribly because I'm playing Assault on Doomrock. That is the way of things. Nonetheless, the sheer amount of variety, even setting aside the different modules in Assault on Doomrock, really leaves the base edition in the dust, but it maintains that one element that really made the game sing and why I first got drawn to Assault on Doomrock, the abstracted terrain system where you get this notion of adjacency and distance, and that's it. That's all you're working on. You're either next to something or you're not. You just have these relationships with different tokens on the map, and so you don't have to count squares for movement. I'm a little past counting squares for movement, and so if you can find a clever way to get rid of that, I'm all in favor. I'm still willing to do it for Space Hulk, but that's about it. Space Hulk got legacied in. Moving forward, I want to minimize the counting of squares and hexes as much as possible. And Assault on Doomrock, therefore, manages to leverage a whole bunch of things, like being overwhelmed, like having moving enemies around in interesting and new and novel ways. I love playing Assault on Doomrock, even as it's completely thrashing me. That's one of the ways that it appeals, to be frank. Shame about the misprint in the current edition, but I am still going to be going back to it on the regular. And that is Assault on Doomrock Ultimate Edition, designed by Tom Stasiak at Beautiful Disaster Games.
I've been playing a couple games on Board Game Arena, which I feel shine. On Board Game Arena. Lots of games I don't enjoy playing because I sort of lose my place or get uninterested. But I've been playing Caverna because it's easy to parse, you know, what your board game state is and the actions that are left and what you need to do to make sure you have some points at the end, what buildings are available, and what conversions you need to make. And you can sit and puzzle everything out. And so you're not rushed when it's your turn. So I enjoy that. Caverna's done by Uwe Rosenberg, put out by Lookout Games. This implementation on Board Game Arena is done by Tissac and Vincent, and continue to love Caverna. Also, Hidden Leaders is the same sort of thing. Hidden Leaders is a very interesting game where you are supporting a particular leader, but no one knows which leader you're supporting. You're allowed to have some cards face up in front of you and some face down, and then there's these meeples moving up and down this track. Some people want the green one for their head, someone want the red one, someone want them close together. So you're not sure who's supporting who. You can sort of maybe guess from the cards they have out. And then all of a sudden, someone has too many cards in front of them and the game ends. And you sort of reveal all your cards and whoever has the most support for the leader that's ahead is the winner. So that sort of leads well into BGA because you can sort of take your time and see what cards are in front of people, see which cards you have, which ones you need to discard, and which ones you should play. This implementation is done by Shun91 on Board Game Arena. Hidden Leaders is designed by Andreas Muller, Marcus Muller, and Raphael Stalker, and it's put out by BFF Games. And the art is amazing.
So much personality in those cards. I really like it.
It's Sayochi Matsurura.
I returned to Aqua Biodiversity in the Oceans. I cannot quit this game, Walker. One of the reasons why I returned to Aqua Biodiversity in the Oceans this time, and this is a review copy sent to us by the publisher, was because it was revealed to me I'm living up to the Sovereign Robot Games brand, to the titling, to the masthead. I got a very significant rule wrong. I had been under the misapprehension that when you cover up a bunch of small animals with a large animal, that you do not score the small animals. No, no, no. You score all of them. This is a good news, bad news situation. I'm not going to be that guy, you know, that guy who plays a game wrong and says, I think I prefer my way better. That's not what I'm going to say. What I am going to say is that this does flatten the decision base a little bit in terms of the basic scoring conditions. With the base scoring conditions 1 through 6, there's a whole bunch available in the box, 18 total. And you pick 6 for a given game. With the base scoring conditions, there was a trade-off about whether or not you wanted to cover very things up. And so you had to make some large animals to trigger scoring conditions, but then you had to build other small animals uncovered to actually satisfy them. Now it's a little bit more simple, streamlined, a little bit more vertical integration. You know, you use the small animals that will then score by virtue of the large animal that they then make. So it's a little bit of latticing as opposed to a trade-off. So that's not necessarily to my taste necessarily. But if you play the way the game is quote-unquote supposed to be played, according to Cognoscenti...
Quote-unquote.
No. I don't mean by the actual rules, but the sort of scenario. The game in the box, Aqua recommends you start with 1 through 6, then you play 7 through 12, and then when you're a full grown-up, there are some scenarios available, but you also just play a random victory conditions. And apparently random victory conditions are the way to go. I played a game with random victory conditions. It's fine. I mean, look, I played Aqua now about half a dozen times, and every time I'm like, this is very colorful. I love the art by Vincent Duclay. That's great.
And it equals up to very much of all the others of their like.
Yeah.
Right? It's just as good as Cascadia, just as good as Calico.
Yeah.
But if you already have those.
I would say it's very different from Calico. Again, there's this axis that I keep identifying. On the one end, you have Cascadia, and on the other hand, you have Calico. They're all nature slash animal themed, cute slash bright and visually appealing, simple tile layers, but they all feel very different because Calico feels like it's trying to murder you from the inside out by virtue of how agonizing the scoring conditions are, whereas Cascadia is far more friendly. And look, I do prefer Aqua to things like Cascadia, but the problem is, here's one of the reasons why I can't really enthusiastically recommend something like Aqua. And the reason is, when it comes to light tiling games, there's this guy named Reiner Knizia who designed half a dozen brilliant tiling games of a similar or lighter rules grit than Aqua Biodiversity in the Oceans, and designed about 12 more that are at least as good or better than Aqua Biodiversity of the Oceans. And so when I'm playing Aqua, I'm like, could have been playing Gnar, could have been playing any number of these other tile layers.
Blue, yeah, exactly.
And... okay, it's fine, it's fine, it's okay, it's fine. It's a nice little bagatelle. And honestly, if you want to be driven by the visual appeal, by all means, go forth and take whichever one tickles your fancy the most. But in a market that is currently dominated by the trend of nature-themed ones, you know, Aqua may or may not be your preference by virtue of the how the scoring conditions shake out. It's a whole bunch of different ways to enforce these weird pattern-insistent scoring conditions, and that's kind of the trend. It's like the tiling equivalent of the Roll-and-Write. Roll-and-Writes are filling out spreadsheets. All these tilings are setting out these patterns. I would much rather, personally, play a tiling game with more direct player interaction because we're all playing on the same board. Whether it's the more recent stuff like Blue Lagoon, whether it's the perennial classics like Through the Desert, whether it's some of the slightly more thinky stuff like Samurai, or whether it's the full-blown complexity of Tigris and Euphrates, that's of course a different category. I wouldn't put them in the same bucket at all because Tigris and Euphrates is considerably more complicated. Anyway, Aqua is fine. Aqua Biodiversity of the Oceans is fine. I think I'm done with it. I felt I was done with it after the first couple plays, but I kept going back for a variety of reasons past my control. I think this is like the Trials of Hercules, not that I'm Hercules, or the Curse of Ixion, not that I'm as bad as Ixion. I think I can be done with it now. I think now I can walk away from Aqua and now die.
It's okay, Mark. It's all over now.
Aqua Biodiversity of the Oceans by Dan Halstead and Tristan Halstead. It's fine. It's fine.
It's fine. We got to play Project Elite today because we got some nice 3D printed terrain to go with it. And it was nicely painted for us as well by Louis. He enjoys that type of thing, and it makes such a difference to the board. It does give a little bit of play problems. You know, if you're a little too low on the board, you might not be able to see how the arrows go, and line of sight might. But I think the trade-offs are worth it. It looks fantastic. Project Elite is a real-time dice-rolling type game where these aliens are streaming in towards your base, and you have all sorts of different objectives that you have to fight your way through while you're furiously rolling dice and trying not to get eaten by aliens. All sorts of different bosses and weapons and tons of different... There's like two full expansions I think we have never touched.
We've dipped our toe into a couple, like the giant segmented worm, the modular map I've never played. I don't know if you've ever played the modular map. We've only played the fixed maps, but we've experimented with some of those. And I agree that there's a tremendous amount of variety. I just like to double down on things we've been talking about lately. Kulmini or Not doesn't always put all of their stretch goals through the paces very well. I have a little bit more faith in things done by Eric Lang. Even then, there's some dodgy stuff. But I feel like in Project Elite was one of the first signs where even as a fan of Kulmini or Not at the time, I would look at some of the characters and say, this wasn't playtested. You know, some of the meat with the rules as written just flatly don't work. And some of them are just all over the map. And I don't think that all of them are necessarily going to lead to quality experiences. So I do think a certain stronger editorial hand would have been useful for the asymmetric characters for the one case. And that's pretty easy. Just try to be a little skeptical about some of the more outre effects. And the other factor with Project Elite, and this is not a ding on Kulmini or Not's version, this has always been a feature of the game. If the card draws clump up in a certain way, you're going to have a rough go of it. And that is exactly what happened to us this time. There are three different spawn points. And if one spawn point keeps getting hit repeatedly, what that means is necessarily the line is going to be pushed because there's no room for the new monsters. And so the existing ones just get pushed closer and closer and closer, giving you less room to maneuver, less of a margin for error. And it was wild. Round one, spawn point two kept getting pushed. Round two, spawn point three kept getting pushed. It was just, they all clumped in a terrible, terrible way. It's all right. I didn't mind that experience, but it was very strange.
Yep. I played a terrible character, which will never get played again. But
it was bad.
There you go. You roll four dice all the time, and when alien results come up, you have to deal with those immediately. And that's what moves the aliens down towards your base. And my ability was every time you rolled two alien icons, you had to take a wound. There was another two icons that healed you, but of course they didn't come up as much.
Nope.
And I died, and that ends the game.
Self-inflicted wound.
Yes. Out he goes.
Force majeure.
The other
thing I'd like to stress is that I was reminded that I think Project Elite is best with a smaller player count because the ratio of gameplay to fiddling around where aliens are moving on a two-player game is very good because you hardly spend any time fiddling with alien maneuvering. When things get more bunched up, and again, this was particularly bad because they kept clumping up on the same spawn points, there's no room for everybody, there's conga lines, there's 20 figures on the board, and they all need to be moved one space, and it starts getting a little obnoxious. I'm perfectly willing to play with four, but I don't think that's where Project Elite is at its best. I think it is much better with two or three, and also much better if the cards don't decide that you're going to lose. Such is the way of things.
Project Elite.
We played another game of Lacuna. This is a review copy we got from the publisher, designed by Mark Garrett and published by CMYK. Lacuna is the absolutely gorgeous, incredibly simple, abstract two-player game where you're playing with these lovely, chunky metal pieces and you're drawing lines and collecting. It's about collecting flowers.
You shake out the flowers.
You put
this nice cloth map and you shake.
You shake the flowers out
and they bounce around the board and they create this nice little pattern.
It's delightful.
And then the head-to-head backstabbing starts.
Well, it's not even backstabbing. It's not like brain burnery, but nonetheless, it's the case that you're... I was thinking about this, honestly, in the context of my discussion of how some dexterity games end up feeling a little bit like tabletop miniatures games. I get that sense as well from Lacuna. There are no fixed spaces, and so it has the same sort of abstracted positioning element of games like Doomrock. But here it's more about distances rather than just an abstract representation of adjacent or non-adjacent. Because after you're done placing all your pieces, you claim pieces by putting one of your tokens in between two flowers of the same color. But at the end of the game, all the flowers get awarded to whoever has the closest token to it. So you start thinking about blocking off areas of the board. And you start thinking, well, if I put it here, I can basically claim this entire segment unless my opponent places suboptimally just to deny me a couple of pieces. And maybe that'll be a priority, maybe it won't. And you start placing your pieces in that way, and then there are more horizons that open up. I think, well, if I place over here, that actually prevents my opponent from placing in this entire sector of the board as well. So that'll get it to me by default. Unless, of course, they're open up that area of the board through two other placements. Anyway, Lacuna is an absolute hit, and I think that it's been correctly observed that in terms of rules difficulty to quality of gameplay, it is probably better than, I think, any other design of the past year. And I think also in terms of just tactile delight, it gets a lot done well. CMYK really has a good sense of matching components to design. I enjoyed Fuzzies as well. Fuzzies was a very cute dexterity game. And CMYK, I think, is really from going to strength to strength. I'm a huge fan of Lacuna, even though, again, it is a style of game, namely a positional abstract, that is typically not my bag. But it's so breezy and approachable and tactile that I find it very difficult to say anything bad about Lacuna. I wish it played multiplayer. There you go. That is my criticism of Lacuna. How dare you just be a brilliant two-player game, it's Lacuna? True. Why couldn't you also Julienne Fries? So that is Lacuna by Mark Garretts, published by CMYK.
We also played a new game by Casper Lapp. This is called Five Towers. It's published by Deep Print Games. And I wish I could say it was a quick, because I think it would shine a lot more if it was quicker. It is a card game.
It's pretty quick. It's not as quick as it wants to be. It was like around 30 minutes rather than 20, which sounds like a small difference, but it actually feels like it could. I don't think it dragged, but I agree with you. It wasn't quite as punchy as one would want it to be.
Yeah, so you're building these five different colored towers, and you're building them from bidding on a display of five cards every round. And that's the key part of the game, is knowing what the initial bid is going to be, because you have to use, say, you can bid five is maximum, because there's five cards. If you bid five, you win all the cards, but you have to use all of the cards. If you bid three and you win the bid at three, then you have to take three of the five cards, and they must fit into your tower display, because you have to start high numbers and then they must go lower as you go.
It reminds me an awful lot of Lost Cities Rivals, which was Rainer Knizia's multiplayer auction-based version of Lost Cities, because like in Lost Cities, in Five Towers, you have to build these ascending sets. And if you've already played the 10, that means you can't play the 11 because that's too low. I mean, there are some exceptions in both games. And obviously the numbers change. I know there's no 11 in Lost Cities. Yes, thank you very much. But you take my point. The difference is that the bidding system in Lost Cities is a closed economy money system where you pay the losers and you take the necessary cards. But they both share the element that taking cards is dangerous, both because it forecloses future placements and because if you cannot use the cards that are available, that sets things up for your opponent. So, for example, in Five Towers, when there's a flop of five cards, and again, your bid is the number of cards you're willing to take, I might really want two of those cards, but I can't make a strong bid unless I can place the other cards. If I can bid five, place those other three cards, or do something with them, that's no thing, and I get the two that I really want. But if the two that I really want come up with cards I can't play because I've overcommitted elsewhere, I'm really in trouble, and I probably won't get the cards that I want. Maintaining that flexibility is the name of the game. I thought it was interesting, but I thought it suffered in comparison to Lost Cities Rivals. And again, I thought that those crucial timing elements sometimes were you were more the victim of the flop than the other way around. And again, the shaving 10 minutes off would be great. Now, this is in the context also of Casper Lapp's other designs. Casper Lapp remains one of the designers we're very much looking at. He of That's Not a Hat and Gods Love Dinosaurs, just two designs off the top of my head. I enjoyed Magic Maze. Walker has a very strong detestation of Magic Maze. Hashtag moving left is not a game. But Casper Lapp is very, very interesting. And I really like the central auction mechanism. It's kind of cute. The way that it's implemented, it seems like it seems more like half a game rather than a full, really good filler, I think.
Agreed.
Another note about Five Towers is the art is charming and borderline actionable. So let's start with the charming. It's called Five Towers, but not all of them are actual towers. One of them is cake, and another one is a tree. You know, I would say only two of the five are like legit straightforward towers. And they're populated with a whole bunch of cartoon denizens. I realized this about halfway through round three or four, and I looked down, and I'm like, this is not a legally distinct diminutive arboreal humanoid alien. This is an Ewok. There is no confusing this with anything other than an Ewok. And then everyone's like, oh yeah, I've got two Pokemon in mine, and
that's definitely Kirby.
That's Kirby, and so look, I have to admire the art team behind Deep Print Games and Pegasuspiel for publishing this. Because you do not typically want to mess with Nintendo and Disney in terms of, like, I'm not joking when I call it borderline actionable. These are very obviously drawings of things. Not inspired by. This is not Pal World to Pokemon. This is not some sort of... This is not like, oh, this is a different kind of Space Marine, so get off my back, Games Workshop. No, no, no. Am I wrong?
Not wrong at all.
It's an interesting move. I can't say that I've ever seen its like in the context of board game design. It's wild. That's Five Towers by Casper Lapp, Deep Print Games, and Pegasus Spiel.
Those are the games we played this week. And now on to the news and why it doesn't matter. So, Mark, we like Kemet.
We do.
And Madagot has a great history of fantastic games.
Well, they've done a number of very good games. They've also published Yucatan.
They did. Anyway, maybe to survive or bounce back from Yucatan, they're going to have a new crowdfunding campaign for Kemet. It's going to be called Rise of the Gods. It's going to include a solo mode and a sixth god for a sixth player.
Sixth player Kemet.
And oh, I know that sounds
painful.
Doesn't
sound great.
Just saying.
I mean, we tried it once when we played with the set module in the first edition of Kemet. Didn't shake out very well.
And there'll be other modules as well. So new crowdfunding campaign to survive Yucatan disaster.
Well, I don't know.
No, I know.
We don't actually know the bottom line. It's just even people who liked Yucatan or people who didn't hate it as much as we did. The rulebook wasn't great. There were a number of issues with its fulfillment. We're probably giving them too hard a time. Madagot has done some good designs.
It's true.
Yeah. So once again, this is a repeat from last week, but I just want more people to know about it. Burned from Stone Circle Games is on Kickstarter now. It's a great hidden movement two-player card game. It is cheap. It's cheerful. It's visually delightful. It has a lot of options in it, and I thoroughly enjoy the gameplay. And so I think that more people need to check it out. This is Burned on Kickstarter right now from Stone Circle Games, designed by John Moffat. Unfortunately, they've plastered a whole bunch of quotes from some maroon up on the Kickstarter page. So yeah. That's probably what's driving people away.
It's true. Ignore those. Content creators don't always know what they're talking about.
That's an understatement of the year.
So the one part of Dead of Winter I did like was the Crossroads system. And there's going to be a new Crossroads game coming out. This is called Wandering Galaxy, a Crossroads game from Plat Hat Games. So I'm very much interested in looking more into this. And if you enjoyed the Crossroads system, it was mostly everyone was drawing these event cards from a main deck. And they always pertain to either a certain situation or a certain character. And so you would be interrupting turns. And it wasn't always to like mess them up completely, but it gave you all these like, you know, side storylines and interesting interaction between players. Wandering Galaxy.
Yeah, there have been a couple of Crossroads games since Dead of Winter. None of them have really caught on. I've always been vaguely curious about the system, but they keep changing it up. But yeah, I'm vaguely curious about this upcoming one as well.
And that's the news and why it doesn't matter. And now a quick break to pay some bills. This episode is brought to you by the Spring Cleaning Champions, Manscaped. This season, make sure to groom your carpets and your drapes with the leaders of the below-the-waist grooming. Clear out that winter bush with Manscaped's Lawnmower 5.0 and watch your confidence bloom like springtime flowers. Embrace the season and join the 10 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped with our special offer. Go to manscaped.com, use code SOWRONGGAMES for 20% off, plus free shipping. And speaking of spring showers, not to worry, this bad boy's waterproof, shave in the shower, in the bath, in the ocean. Like I said, get 20% off, free shipping, with code SOWRONGGAMES at manscaped.com. That is 20% off, free shipping, with the code SOWRONGGAMES at manscaped.com. Nothing like a little spring cleaning in your pants.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
And now we're back with our feature game, Nucleum.
Nucleum was designed by Simone Luciani and David Cerce, two very...
wonderful? Cheery?
Those things they may be. Prolific board game designers was the word I was looking for. Simone Luciani is one of the Italian masters. He has designed, I'm just going to pick one in particular to emphasize at this moment, Barrage, both one of our favorite Euro games of the past few years and also very relevant to a discussion of Nucleum. And David Cerce, he of every solo mode ever, with its own separate 20-page rulebook and new deck of cards in order to play the darn thing, as well as a bunch of designs that we are very fond of, such as co-designing Imperium and Voidfall, as well as designing Anachrony. This is their first major collaboration, published by Board and Dice last year. Walker, why don't you give us an unhelpful summary about what one does in Nucleum?
So it was Midsummer's Night Day, and Braz and Brass met on the pagoda, drinks in hand. Or maybe I should sum this up. I got a 15-page fan fiction of this love affair.
Okay, should we save this Brass for our OnlyFans, or should we do it right now?
No, all right. We'll do it later.
Okay.
All right, long story short, Barrage and Brass had this mutant nuclear baby, and it is called Nucleum. And it's very much, you're lining up multiple actions because the board state is going to change, but it's not that hard. You have this long list of different actions you can take, and there's tons of things that you want to do. And it's very much, I know they say interaction, it's like, oh, someone just took something that you wanted. But this is every turn in multiple ways. There's contracts that you want. There's action tiles that you want. There's map placements that you want. There's end of phase things that when someone passes, you wanted to be the one to do that. So there's all these things happening and you need to figure out, you know, what is the most important thing to you and how to get there faster. Nucleum.
Huh. I don't know if I'd describe it that way. Okay, so let's start where starting is good. Very much like a lot of Euro games, the player interaction, as Walker alluded to, primarily comes from getting the stuff before other people do. So we'll talk about the map later, because the map's an entire kettle of fish. I typically didn't feel that pressure all the time. Now, I felt it perhaps slightly more than the purest of multiplayer solitaire Euro games. But in terms of, for example, purchasing new action tiles, because the last game we played, I very, very much misplayed the last third of the game, and I left myself with no action tiles of a certain action type. There are 5 action types in Nucleum, and you have the ability to lose some of them. Again, more on the map later. You lose them by putting them on the map. Now, there's a safety valve. You have a wild tile that you cannot get rid of, and so you're never completely put yourself in a hole, but you are able to take a variety of risks that may or may not pay off and or a bunch of boneheaded decisions that are going to put you in a corner. This much I appreciate, to be clear. But in terms of the player interaction itself, there's just, you know, a display of action tiles. And if an action tile comes up that you really want, you should probably just go take it. I mean, it's I don't really...
But there's contracts as well.
How often is it the case that you're going to need all of those things at once such that you're not able to just go get the thing you want?
In the last play, it was almost every turn.
Really?
Yeah.
Wild. Because I over all the plays of Nucleum, I can think of maybe 2 or 3 times total across all the kinds of things where someone snaked something and I felt I really wanted that. And most of the time, it's because that thing just came up in the flop. You know, I'm player 1, player 2 refreshes the market somehow, and then either player 3 or 4 takes the thing that came up that was really nice. So, I mean, honestly, whatever I have to say about Nucleum, heavily player interactive is not one of the ways that I would characterize it.
No, but I mean, in the genre of I took this before someone else did, I think it does a great job of making it much more important than other games.
Huh.
Because not only are some of the player tokens better than others, mm-hmm. but there's the color combinations that you need as well. Like there's a certain joint that you need the orange white.
Yeah, like a spiky joint.
There's that certain orange-white one there that has not only the colors that you need, but also the actions that you want. Hmm. And then someone just takes it for the sake of taking it or whatever. Same sort of thing with the contracts. There's these purple contracts, and there's two of them line up, like, say, have the most houses or have X number of houses out. And so there's a lower one that says 3 and the higher one that needs 6. So you really want, because you're already sort of heading towards that 6 one.
Right.
So having that 3 one would be great because you're already on your way there. But then someone takes that just because they wanted to take something. And another reason why, because it's very important to sort of cycle your contracts too. So getting them chained properly is great because every time you place a contract, you get bennies, right? So being able to satisfy them quickly and get new ones in is pretty important.
This has not been my experience playing Nucleum. Again, it feels reasonably head down. Yeah, someone takes the building spot you wanted, but that means you have to pay $2 extra to build in the worst building spot. If you compare it to slightly more interactive Euros, like, for example, Barrage, where the building spots really matter and you can really snake something out from somebody. And on top of that, you also have the competitive element of there are these advanced technologies available that I'm going to take that you can't. I definitely feel that that Nucleum is much more head down than something like Barrage.
For sure.
But then again, Barrage, maybe that's an unfair comparison. It's the obvious one, but I feel that Nucleum is, if anything, just to keep within the oeuvre of the existing designers that we're talking about, I feel that Nucleum is about as player interactive as Anachrony, which is to say not very.
All right, let's talk about the map.
Let's talk about the map. Because this is one area where I think that Nucleum is quite clever in a number of ways, and where I think the brass comparison has some teeth. Why don't you set the stage?
Well, first of all, I hate the painful part as well. They've snaked the continents in a certain way where you think some should be adjacent, but they're not. In order to get the track so that these two connect, you need to you thought it'd be like 2 and you could just cut across there. No, you need like a 15 track combination to work your way around because they've just tucked that in a corner and made it look like it's adjacent.
It's true.
And it's not. Anyway, that's being silly and way over the top. But.
Well, no, I think it's relevant. I think we should touch back on this idea later, but go on.
So what you actually do on the map is very much like Brass. You are putting out these buildings that you need to power, much like you do in Brass, except it's a little bit more forgiving because when you actually go to power them, you can use anyone's tracks and you bring in the power.
Not it has only that relationship that Brass and Age of Industry have, whereby sometimes it matters a lot who owns a given railway, and sometimes it doesn't matter at all who owns a given railway. And I like that dynamic, but at the same time, it does lead to a fair bit of confusion.
It's true. But how this differs is that the important energy, the Nucleum, the uranium
that gets processed at a Nucleum plant
is yours and cannot be taken, unlike Brass, where
correct.
The timing of that particular situation is crucial.
There's a little bit of a rush for cheap coal, but past that, it's not an interesting fluctuating market like you're going to find in Brass, where the price of iron and coal is going to go up or down and you really want to be able to maintain the supply. It's just as the game goes on, coal gets more expensive, flat.
But at least for me, it's a little more enjoyable. You're not so much fighting the game constantly. Keeping things in network is a constant problem in Brass, not so much here in Nucleum, because all you need to do is take one of your action tiles that you think you don't want to use anymore, and you place it on the map into a new area, and now that is in your network. Now you can build buildings there, and multiple people can have tracks on the same single line, and that counts for everyone that has a track there. So it's a lot more forgiving, a little bit more open, so you can concentrate on the plethora of other things that are going on in Nucleum.
Yeah, you're going to find that if you desperately need to get a certain thing done, there's a way to do it. You're not going to build yourself into a corner. I think that's kind of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, you feel a sense of flexibility so that you can focus on the action chaining that you want to do for maximum efficiency. But by the same token, I never feel like I'm forced to pivot. And by virtue of the fact that I'm never really forced to pivot, I might be forced to do an action slightly out of sequence. I might be forced to do half of an action that I wouldn't have otherwise done just as a prerequisite for something else. But unlike games like Barrage or like Age of Industry or Brass, sometimes I look at the map and say, it's like, well, that thing that I wanted to do, I just can't do anymore. And yeah, that may be bad for certain people with a certain frustration threshold, but I do appreciate it at times like this where a game can force me to have strategic horizons, but adapt when it is the case that that plan is no longer feasible. Nucleum, I agree with you, is slightly more permissive, but again, this is a preference thing. I would prefer if it had been perhaps slightly less permissive in the sense of forcing me to have to shoehorn my way into an area rather than just, Prague's where it's at. I'll have plenty of time to go to Prague. Oh, look at that. Now my horizon is not within the next 6 turns. It has to be in the next 5. Okay. I never really felt rushed like I had to do anything. Again, I think this goes back to our differing experiences with respect to the player interaction. When it came down to playing Nucleum, I felt like more or less I had the horizons that I needed to do what I needed to do at all times, which in turn leads to my biggest complaint, I think, all told about Nucleum, which is every play has felt more or less the same. There's not really a tremendous dynamic range of actions available, like this specialized action tile that you build at a $1 discount. Now, that's really powerful. Like, it's a good tile to have, but it's not going to blow your socks off. It's not like it's not like even some of the cool techs that you're going to find in Barrage. It's not like really being able to get out those high-value buildings even in Brass. And so it's, all the mechanisms come together in a neat way. But, you know, the combination of the head down and just being able to do whatever it is that I need to do, I felt like I was on autopilot.
Well, I feel as though maybe that's just a sort of style of play. I just think it feels, not as in your style of play, I mean style of play of what this particular game is trying to accomplish.
Sure.
I think there's just a lot of game for the time it takes to play. And for people to have to pivot or to have all sorts of different things you can do, I think that would bog the game down.
That's fair.
Sufficiently, right? This game has tons going on and can be played. This is with Teach and Teardown was 2 hours.
Yeah.
Multiple times. And that is a lot of game for that short time span.
I guess, but you can... I feel like you can do you can do the rules explanation, play and tear down with Barrage and Age of Industry as well. And again, these are the natural comparison sets. They feel an awful lot like the love child of these two games. And with respect to Nucleum, if we're going to talk about the setup is such a pain.
This is what I had at the very beginning. Yeah. Let me just cover the one point before we go too far. And that's the difference in from game to game.
Okay.
And the fact that there are 4 different sort of player sets, A, B, and C, and they'll give you completely different...
Not completely I shouldn't different. Say, sorry. There's overlap.
I was about to come back.
Yeah.
Not completely different, but slightly different action tiles.
This one gives you a money after you power.
Okay.
This one gives you a worker after you power. No, they're cool. It's nice to be able to unlock these various toys. But if you compare it to the kind of way that you get toys in almost any other Euro, you get a fixed set, and they're important... But some of them are kind of cool, but none of them spark the same kind of joy.
And then there's a list of technologies, which fall into exactly the same boat. A lot of them are the same as everyone else.
Yeah.
And the ones that are different are just slightly different in a different way. But they are different. And there are definitely different strategies to each sort of technology set.
Yes. The thing that I most liked about the new action tiles that come up is not even necessarily their effects, but just the ability to tune my economy the way that it wanted. It's like... I'm at the stage now in my gameplay. Again, I always felt like I ended up at roughly the same place in Nucleum. Like a successful strategy looks more or less the same. Unlock a couple things in whatever order you please. Make a push to Prague. Build a couple high-value buildings in Prague and power them. And again, you can do them in almost any order. And ultimately, the thing that was more satisfying than the necessary end state or the specific powers on the specific tiles was... what kind of economy of actions was I able to build on the way there? Now, is it the case that I find building really easy because I've got these 3 building tiles and I can build 3 times as fast as anybody else? That part I found more satisfying rather than the specifics of the action tiles themselves, for what it's worth.
All right, so the setup.
Oh, boy.
Let's talk about the action tiles first. They want a nice even mix, so they have 2 different sets of action tiles. They sort of like the generic ones that you're going to use every time, and then they want you to mix in a certain number of specialty ones, and so you have to count those out, and then you have to mix them all together and then create your stacks, and then you have all your techs that you have to set up. You have a different piles of contracts. You have gold, silver, and purple ones that they all have to be sorted out, and they have their player count specific milestone tokens that need to be put out. Then you have to populate the board. There's all of the coal import wagon tiles you have to put out. You have to then you have to start flipping these, you know, setup cards. It's going to tell you which city is going to have a nuclear site, where all the neutral urban buildings are going to go, because you have to have, there's a bunch of neutral buildings that you're allowed to power. If it's less than four players, then buckle up. There's all of these other things that need to be covered in a four-player game. And then you get to populate your player board. And I'm not even going to go into things like that. There are 32 things that you need to place. That is the number.
In professional kitchens, it would be called touches. It's the number of touches. Yeah. And if you're playing Nucleum back to back to back, you might remember some of these things and you can divvy up the tasks and it'll make things relatively quick. But all of these details are exactly the kind of detail you forget if you haven't played Nucleum for like 10 days. It's like, oh, wait, how do the action tiles work again? Oh, geez. Okay. And this leads to Teardown as well, because everything needs to be sorted in its specific tile, a specific pile. There are effectively 6 different piles of action tiles. All of them are going to be scattered across the map because that's how train links get made. You put your action tiles there. Clever and cool and a fun and an interesting and novel mechanism, but also makes tearing everything down a bit of a bear. It's a whole thing.
Yeah, so let's talk more about these action tiles, because there's a lot of interesting things that are going on. We've already talked about the sort of decisions you have to make on using them for actions or putting them out on the board. And putting it on the board, if you match, because all the different cities are color-coded and the multiple track segments are also color-coded. So if you put them out on the board and they match colors, then you can still do the actions anyway. And if they match both sides, then that's the two actions. The same as if you'd put it at the top of your board as, you know, play an action, you still get to do both of those actions. And why you'd want to put it at the top of your board is because there's this cool.
Whatever you say, Daddy.
Income method, because you have 3 tracks that are going to go up for certain reasons during the game. It's coins, workers, and victory points. And as your action tokens line up at the top of the board, and whenever you do decide to pass, you're only going to get as much income as...
It's the lower of your track or the number of action tiles you've placed. So effectively, you can run up your income track of whatever type, but you can't keep pumping it ad infinitum by passing over and over, because you only get to the highest level as indicated by the number of action tiles.
I thought it was very interesting. And lots of sort of trade-offs on when you want to pass, because not only is it you want to get more action tiles up there so you get more income, but there is this sort of king scoring thing, and also getting to the certain milestones, because as you power buildings through the energize action, you're acquiring these stars, and whenever you do pass, you have to cash in all of these stars, and it's going to put you at a certain position on the milestone track. And in all of the positions, there is a new nuclear reactor, and the first one to get a marker in there gets to decide what city it's going to go into. And more often than not, it was a fairly important decision.
Yeah, this is the overall dynamic of this round structure, or lack thereof, is the key virtue that I think Nucleum has over its clear competitors, specifically in this case Barrage. Because Barrage has a very rigid traditionalist turn structure, whereby at the end of the round you compare how much power everyone's generated and there's a scoring. In the context of Nucleum, you do the scoring at regular intervals based on when people have passed. Somebody may be drowning in action tiles and have really, really good income tracks, and they're perfectly happy to do 6-7 consecutive actions without passing. Somebody else, on the other hand, might not have the action tiles or might have done something else. They might pass relatively quickly. And consequently, there's a greater degree of flexibility with respect to things as compared to Barrage. And that I very much appreciated. And that part I thought was neat. Sometimes it can lead to situations where, you know, your most advantageous thing to do is just pump your income tracks. And that's okay. And it also dovetails with another aspect of the economy that I very much appreciated. Namely that although the chief way to get these aforementioned stars, which are going to be competitive for a variety of reasons, is by powering buildings, it's not the only way. And sometimes those extra 2 or 3 notches on the track can make all the difference. And so if you found a way to do little exploits here and there, some tech sets are better at this than others, some action tiles are better at this than others. But I did appreciate trying to find that extra little margin that might push me over through non-powering agencies, and I thought that was neat.
Yeah, it's a little bit like Bloodstone, where once everyone has taken that pass action, then it invokes this king scoring, and whoever has the highest on that milestone is going to get more
more victory points.
And that could be the same threshold over and over. Again, unlike Barrage where it resets every round, in Nucleum, if you do a really, really solid power production round, your marker just stays there and it could win first place potentially three times consecutively. That would be very, very difficult because in the first round, you're not going to be doing much. But, you know, second round and third round, it's conceivable. Or at the very least, it might stick around to score second place. That's more plausible. Can we talk about the theme a bit?
Sure.
I would classify it as aggressively stupid. Now, I don't know.
In the theming of board games, I don't think it's excessively stupid. I've seen much stupider things.
Okay, here's why. It's, first of all, it's one of those Euros where our rules explainer is apt to skip saying what the theme is entirely. And then the materials are going to kind of imply that it's a contemporary setting. You're like, oh, no. This is supposed to be like a weird alternate history magic version of oldie times. Like, okay.
It's like electricity's for chumps. We're going right to nuclear.
Well, it's not. Well, nuclear is still electricity, yeah. But that's the point. On the one hand, you know, personal biases straight on the table. It's kind of pro-nuclear, and I like that. But at the same time, it kind of runs away from... No. This isn't nuclear power. This is Nucleum. You process uranium at a Nucleum reactor. What's Nucleum? Oh, well, it's magic, old-timey, historical nuclear power. It's just really weird and silly.
It's Nuki Punk.
I don't know. Like
TM.
It's just... Okay, maybe not aggressively stupid. It's aggressively silly.
Yes.
And not in a particularly funny way.
No. Not or interesting.
Yeah. It's once again a missed opportunity. You can make a Euro game about anything. It doesn't even really have a consistent visual style so they can get away with it. I mean, again, Barrage and Brass, they're very much sort of... Barrage kind of sort of plays with steampunk a little bit. But not to the extent of ridiculousness that Nucleum does. And they at least have a sort of consistent visual style and tone in a way that Nucleum doesn't. But, you know, again, at this point, I'm quibbling.
I don't know. They have frogs and spaceships. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, not officially frogs. We call them frogs and spaceships. Similarly, Brass doesn't have, what is it, orphan stompers? But you call them that anyway.
It's also true. All right. Let's talk about Endgame, because I think that is another nice hook. Is that there's multiple endgame conditions, but if only two of them trigger, then the end of the game is going to start. And there's like emptying the contracts. There's once everyone's passed three times, there's everyone gets all the technologies. There's the action tile things. So multiple ways. And not only that, the first person to any of these endgame goals will also get some victory points. And I found that semi-interesting.
Yeah, often you end with a couple of the other endgame conditions circling around the same timing, but there is actually a difference in terms of which ones tend to get exhausted first. Like sometimes someone's super aggressive at getting a whole bunch of action tiles that they probably don't need, and so that might push that in-game condition. Someone might be really aggressive at scoring in-game points as opposed to end-game points, and therefore push that in-game condition. And the end can actually happen pretty precipitously. Somewhat disappointingly, it is often in your best interest once the endgame has been triggered just to pass, because by the end of the game, your income tracks are probably pretty high, and your victory point endgame track might be, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 points just for passing. So it's a little bit of anticlimax, but all told, the endgame conditions are pretty solid.
Yeah, because scores will end up being around in the 200 range, a little bit lower, maybe 150 to 200 range, which leads sort of back to... I just want to go back because I forgot to touch on the milestone track. When you cash in your sort of main milestone markers, you can just take, you can allow to put it anywhere lower than what you've generated. When you generate power and you cash in your power generating thing, you can say, oh, I only want to generate this for multiple reasons, because you only have one marker in each band and there's some scoring conditions there that you want to double up on. But the other thing you can do is just take zero. And that gives you a bunch of resources. And I'm wondering, I think next time I play...
A bunch of strong...
Well, but early game. What I was about to get to, early game, I think I want to try this almost right at the beginning, is pass, take the hit, because negative three in a 200-point
game... You're right, the points are not
going
to be considerable. Yeah.
I think that jump to your income right at the beginning might be pretty big.
Possibly. Resources are reasonably tight in Nucleum. Not super tight, but reasonably tight. and that additional influx might be helpful. It's just there are a lot of things you can do effectively for free, especially at the early game. You know, you can take a contract for free and then slot it in one of the slots that give you resources, which is to say any of them. So, you know, if you pass, sure, you can pass, take the 3 victory point hit and get a worker and $2. But you can also just take a contract and get $2. Now, granted, then you're stuck with that contract. But, you know, as I say, I generally feel like I end up in roughly the same place in every game of Nucleum that I've played. And so the prospect of taking a contract that I'm not in any position to satisfy now, but shrug and expect that I'll probably be in a position to satisfy it later, is usually not too much of a restriction. So I, you know, the rulebook emphasizes that this is a viable strategy, but people are risk averse and look at the -3 points and get gun shy.
It's true. But like I said, it's usually always new players and they don't realize that the score threshold is going to be in the, you know, 150 range and three yeah. points is no big deal.
It's true. It's true. I would be more worried about spending an entire action just to get one worker and two money. If that was the way you were going. Now, if your tracks are well situated, if there are other exogenous reasons to pass before you've generated power, absolutely. It's a nice little capper. It might make sense.
And then there's putting the game away.
it's just like the setup. It's just, you know, yeah. Some games are onerous to set up, but tearing them down is super simple. Not so much with Nucleum. I mean, look, ultimately, I can respect what they're doing. I do like how Nucleum mixes things up. You can clearly see the progenitors. But at the same time, the way the action tiles dovetail with the map, the way the round structure is more flexible, I very, very much appreciate those innovations, as it were, or those mechanical variations. But ultimately, I'm left feeling like I would rather play its obvious inspirations, partially by virtue of the fact that I feel a certain sense of repetition set in. I feel there's a certain amount of heads down lack of player interaction. I very much appreciate Nucleum on a mechanical level. And I'm happy to play when it's in front of me. And I've enjoyed exploring it to the extent that we have over the course of our plays over the past few weeks. But ultimately, I think that it's, although a very solid entry, it is overshadowed by its parents.
I agree with that completely. But In the particular style lifestyle that I'm living now, where we don't get to play Brass and Barrage multiple times, I feel a game like Nucleum, where you will not get like sort of like a food chain magnet, where you make one mistake and you're almost kind of out of the game, right? Is a little nice change, right? It's a little less stressful. You know,
that's a good point.
You can, you know, you're free to do your own thing. Even if someone, like I said, does take that contract or that action tile, you know, there's other ones that will come up that are just as good, if not better. So not as punishing, but like you said, I definitely, if it was those games were played more often, I would definitely gravitate towards those more.
That's a fair point. It is more approachable. It's still a rules dense game. It's not, it's definitely a medium heavy Euro, but it is not quite as punishing of early mistakes as its progenitors. I will give it that. Let them suffer. And that's going to do it for this week. Thank you very, very much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. You can find all our contact information as well as a whole bunch of other useless and useful information at sowronggames.com. It should be your homepage.
It should be.
It should be the only page you visit.
Why else would you need the internet? I don't.
It's why the internet was invented, Walker.
I think so.
Yeah. We read everything you send us. We'll get back to you if we can. Thanks again for having decided to spend/waste some time with us. We hope to see you again soon.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bigney. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. You can reach us by email at soveryrongaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter at sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.